From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the other son of Shante Kimes. We meet Kent Walker. His mother and younger brother Kenny Kimes were convicted of murdering an elderly widow in Manhattan. They're connected to three other deaths or disappearances, and their other crimes include theft, arson, even slavery. Kent Walker managed to break free of his manipulating mother. He's written a new memoir, Son of a Grifter. Also, part three of our Avant-Garde Made Easy series. This time, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead considers the music of improviser and saxophonist Anthony Braxton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush said today that the United States would help Taiwan defend itself against China. He was asked on ABC television whether that could mean using the full force of the American military, and he replied that the U.S. would do whatever it took to help Taiwan defend itself. Later on, he softened the message slightly by saying that the U.S. supports the One China policy and believes the issue should be resolved peacefully. He denied that his earlier statements marked a change in policy.
People have seen that I'm willing to help Taiwan defend herself, and that nothing has really changed in policy as far as I'm concerned. This is what other presidents have said, and I will continue to say so.
The president made that remark today on CNN. The National Weather Service says the Mississippi has crested at Davenport, Iowa. Flood watchers say the water level topped out at 22.3 feet, just shy of the 1993 record. NPR's Jackie Northam reports from Davenport, Iowa.
The National Weather Service predicts the water level of the Mississippi River will fluctuate around Davenport over the next day, moving up or down an inch or two. Emergency crews continue to monitor for any leaks in the dikes and levees protecting the city's riverfront area. Dump trucks filled with sand will reinforce any breach in the fragile line of defense. More than 1,100 homes and businesses in Iowa have been damaged by this year's flooding. Governor Tom Vilsack has applied for federal disaster aid. On Thursday, Joe Alba, the director of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is due to arrive in the Davenport area. Earlier this week, Alba made it clear that he would take a hard look at whether Davenport has done enough to prevent flooding. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Davenport, Iowa.
45 alleged members and associates of New York's five organized crime families have been arrested on murder, conspiracy, and other racketeering charges. NPR's Melissa Block reports from New York.
The arrest came after a three-year investigation in which an associate of the Genovese family turned government informant and tape-recorded thousands of hours of conversations among the alleged mobsters. According to prosecutors, one Genovese soldier is heard to say, "Hurting people, that's what this is about. If you're not capable of doing that, you might as well stay home." And another defendant says on tape, "No matter who you are killing, it's from the boss. The orders always come from him." Federal authorities say Vincent Chin Giganti remains the boss of the Genovese family, even though he's in prison. In announcing the arrests, U.S. Attorney Loretta Lynch said, quote, "Organized crime members can never relax because they can no longer have confidence that an undercover operative is not lurking in their midst." Melissa Block, NPR News, New York.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow gained 171 points, or 1.6%, to close at 10,625 in active trading. The Nasdaq gained 43 points. This is NPR News. Bridgestone Firestone Tire Company said today that it's begun settlement talks with lawyers for some victims of crashes involving Firestone tires. A spokesman said the company is talking with a Little Rock, Arkansas lawyer who represents many of the victims. Firestone recalled millions of its tires amid reports that they were liable to lose their treads at high speeds. Federal safety officials say they have reports of at least 174 deaths linked to the tires. Most of the crashes were rollovers on the Ford Explorer, a sport utility vehicle that provided Firestone tires as standard equipment. A spectacular new fossil dinosaur is going on display in New York today. This 130-million-year-old specimen sports feathers along its entire body. NPR's Richard Harris has more.
Last year, Chinese farmers came across a remarkable fossil. It's an incredibly well-preserved specimen of a dromaeosaur. It's a flightless reptile closely related to the super predator Velociraptor. But this dromaeosaur is also covered with feathers, according to the scientists who are reporting the find. They say it's further evidence that feathers appeared in dinosaurs first as insulation and possibly as something to attract the opposite sex, not for flight. The fossil itself is about as big as a duck, and it's flattened out in a block of sandstone that was split in two to reveal the bones and feather imprints. Details of the discovery are published in the journal Nature, and the fossil itself is now on display at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.
The California Supreme Court has refused to hear an appeal from O.J. Simpson. The former football star sought to overturn a $33 million wrongful death suit against him. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services in healthcare, education, and corporations. SodexoMarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, sitting in for Terry Gross. The first lines of Kent Walker's new book explain a great deal. I make my living as a vacuum cleaner salesman, he writes. I've met a lot of good liars in my day. None of them are as good as my mother. Kent Walker's mother is Shante Kimes. She's currently serving a life sentence for the murder of Irene Silverman, a wealthy 82-year-old widow. Shante Kimes and her other son, Kenny, killed Silverman as part of a scheme to steal her $10 million townhouse in Manhattan. 25-year-old Kenny Kimes is also in prison for the crime. The mother and son are suspects in other murder cases in California and the Bahamas. Kent Walker is the son who got away. In his new book, Son of a Grifter, he says his mother started using him as an unwitting accomplice when he was very little in crimes including shoplifting, robbery, and arson. Even so, he writes that his mother loved him fiercely. Let me read back some of the descriptions you've written of your mother. Incandescent, superhuman force. You write that she loved you with an unconditional, all-enveloping, fearsome, enormous love. A fearsome love?
Very fearsome. She was on both sides. She could be as evil as evil can get, and she could be as loving as loving can get. The best way to describe my mother, not just her personality, but why she was able to get away with so much, is that there's absolutely nobody on earth who is easier to love than my mother. But there's also no one easier on earth to hate. And it's the same person.
There was one incident when you were small, when you were in a car parked outside of your house. Your mother rushes into the car and realized that she'd forgotten something inside a folder. Can you tell us what happened after that?
Yeah, I was about 7 years old. And Mom asked me to go upstairs and grab a folder for her, and I did. And I come running down the stairs, and right when I got to the front door, the house blew up. And I was thrown into the front yard and had the wind knocked out of me and bruised up pretty good. And probably the first arson, I guess, I participated in with my mother.
But also, she had just sent you into that house where she knew a bomb was about to go off. She'd set the bomb.
Well, it's a good example of what she's like. I don't think that she wanted her son killed, but I think what it was is that there was a situation at hand. She had to make a decision right there, and I was the only tool available to her. And she might have thought it would be faster for me to do it. She might have thought it might be less risk to her. I don't think so, but I've wrestled with that one for a few years.
I think in the next paragraph you write how fiercely she loved you, this mother who sent her 7-year-old son into a house that she knew was about to blow up.
I'm not sure she knew that house was going to blow up. I know that house was meant to burn, but she wasn't very good at her trade of arson. She either used too much stuff or not enough, usually. And I remember she was pretty emotional. I know it surprised her.
Initially, you were used as a decoy for her when you were a little kid. Shante would use you, I guess, to distract clerks while she was shoplifting?
Yeah, I was the cute little boy who people loved to pinch the cheeks on, and she'd introduce us, and then she'd go do her thing.
And I guess there's another level of protection that people assume a mother with a little kid is not going to be a criminal.
Yeah, it's the perfect diversion. It's a perfect diversion. She looked wealthy, no matter what her financial situation was. She was a beautiful woman, which I think sometimes people are more forgiving to people like that. And then you put a little boy with that that's always dressed well and taught to have good manners. It's probably the best diversion you can have.
At various times, your mother would hit you with her fists. She beat you with a wire hanger, would scream at you in incandescent rages that you describe. She tried to break up every relationship you ever had with a girl or later with women, and especially your wife. She hated and abused your wife, slipped her a Mickey at one point to knock her out, hired guys to sleep with her and then take pictures to prove to you that she was being unfaithful. She did all these things, and
I was there.
Yeah, and maybe for an old scam artist, the biggest insult was that she would later try to scam you.
Well, she would she would later do it. When I was younger, I just didn't know anything else. That's what I knew, you know. Most kids, they have the normal household where they come home, they have dinner, go to bed, wake up, go to school. Part of my household was that we'd go steal stuff. I didn't know anything different. When I was old enough to realize the difference, I went through some confusing times. Hey, this is my mother. This is my family. This is what I knew. This is who I loved. As I got older, I had a brother that I felt needed protecting. And I also had a stepfather who needed protecting also. And I thought I was the only one who could do it. And so when you take those type of emotions, for every time that I got hit, I'd have a month of absolute pure joy growing up on a beachfront property in Honolulu. It's not a bad way to live. I miss that sometimes. Our properties, we weren't living in welfare housing. We're living in mansions and beautiful homes. And outside references would envy what I was. They didn't know what was going on the inside. But that envy also made it even more confusing.
Was it fun, the con, the getting away with it, the stealing?
Best way to put it is during the time, all I felt was tension. I, if someone had asked me at that moment, say, are you having fun? I don't think I could have said yes to that. But I do feel the void now. I miss that excitement sometimes.
But being with your mother was extraordinarily fun, you write.
It was. It could be. 90% of the time, this woman, I mean, if they were going to put a definition for charisma, it should say Shante Kimes. The woman was just a powerful force. No one could resist it. You'd probably succumb to it. If she wanted you to be happy, you were the happiest individual in the world. If she wanted you to be miserable, she could accomplish that also.
And often with the same people, you write that there was she would describe burning people, using them up.
Well, Shantae's mind, I don't think anyone will ever figure it out. I know I haven't. If it served her purpose to make sure that you were a friend and that we're happy, then that's what she could do. If it served her purpose for you to be afraid of her, she can do it also. And she could do it in an instant. It could change. You know, most people's emotional states is a gradual process. With my mother's, it was instantaneous. It could be turned off and on just like a light switch, and which made her frightening. But that's how she controlled people also.
Sounds almost some of the same qualities as a cult leader.
It'd be pretty frightening to think if she ever was able to lead a cult. That's a cult that would be pretty scary. Wouldn't want to be around that one.
Describe her for us. What does she look like?
My mother was a very beautiful woman, stunningly beautiful. We would walk into a restaurant and every head would turn and see her. And it wasn't just the way she dressed. She was flamboyant, but she did have a beauty to her also. A smile that would just, it was contagious. It was hard not to be in a good mood when she was happy. You know, her happy state was almost spastic. It was on the line of where you're almost uncomfortable because it's too euphoric, but also at the same time, you feel uncomfortable not enjoying that happiness with her. It's just right there on that line. Curvy woman. I can see why men would be attracted to her. She's a very beautiful woman.
Resemblance to Liz Taylor.
Very strong resemblance to Liz Taylor. In fact, I remember one time at a restaurant where people were asking her for her autograph, thinking that she was Elizabeth Taylor, and she played it to the hilt.
There's a picture that she had on her wall where you say the resemblance to Liz Taylor was striking. In fact, so striking that it probably was a picture of Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah, I'm still wondering about that one, but that's how close she looked to Elizabeth Taylor. Sorry, Liz.
Well, also, not unlike Elizabeth Taylor, she in later life had problems with her weight.
She's always had problems with her weight. My stepfather and her would go out to dinner, and they would split meals. And part of it was because my stepdad was cheap, but part of it because Mom was always on that perpetual diet. But then when she got home, it'd always be mashed potatoes or scrambled eggs. I mean, not stuff that you'd find on a Weight Watchers menu.
And wonder why the pounds weren't coming off.
She was a nervous eater, and unfortunately, the environment she created, she was always nervous. So.
Kent Walker's book is Son of a Grifter. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with Kent Walker, the author of a new book about his life in crime, The Son of a Grifter. It wasn't always about the money with your mother. For many years, she lived as the wife of Ken Kimes, a real estate developer, a millionaire many times over, a $20 million fortune, you estimate. But that didn't stop the shoplifting and the arson.
Made it worse. She was in search for her millionaire. In my young mind, I knew she'd do it. I mean, anything she wanted, she didn't stop till she got it. But I really thought when Ken and me and Mom became a family, especially when Kenny came, that would do it, okay? Bad stuff's behind us.
Kenny's your half-brother born 13 years after you were born?
Almost 13 years, right. Mm-hmm. And it made it worse. And I don't know if it was the combination of Mom and Ken together, because Ken brought a lot of strange character traits to the relationship also that kind of fueled her. You know, he did not disapprove of her criminal activity. In fact, he encouraged it. He liked driving fancy cars without having to pay for them, and he had the money to buy a dealership. But he also had the money to keep her out of trouble. You know, it's a sad standard on the justice system, but let's face it, if you got millions to spend for attorneys, you're gonna milk the justice system and get away with stuff that the average person can't. And I think made Mom feel a little bit more infallible, knowing that she could take the higher risks and she had that $1 million safety net just in case she got caught.
One of the things that she liked to do was steal fur coats.
It was obsession with her. We lived in Hawaii. There's not a real big need for fur coats in Hawaii. In fact, there's not need for fur anything in Hawaii. The weather's beautiful, yet she had 22 of them stashed in her closet. And she wasn't selling them. She wasn't wearing them. She was hoarding them. It was an impulsion. There was no reason for it, and she still did it.
22 fur coats with the linings all ripped out.
Every one of the linings ripped out.
Never
saw a lining. I wouldn't know what a fur coat lining looked like if I saw one today. I can tell what a fur looks like, though.
She also collected people, you describe them in the book as her maids, people who she would later be convicted of holding in involuntary servitude, slaves.
People that she had to control. She couldn't control me, so she controlled the maids.
Now, describe how this worked. She would drive down to Mexico?
There was a lot of different ways. So she'd drive to Mexico. She'd talk friends into finding them for them. The only requirement for the maids, that they'd be naive and that they would be illegal aliens. And she'd get them, talk them in, the ultimate sale, live in a fancy home and be part of this big family and, never paid any of them. But that was an agreement. They all knew that they weren't going to get paid, as far as I know, when they first came to work for us. But they had no idea what was in store for them.
And what was in store for them?
First, she had the honeymoon where everything was wonderful. Mom buying them little gifts. They were called the daughter she never had. Then the transition where she would ask them to do more and more. And then the final round where she was just downright mean to them, were obsessive with clean. I remember as a kid having to scrub the patios out with disinfectant. My hands were raw. And I started bulking at that job, so she got the maids to do stuff like that. I remember walking into our garage, and the ammonia was so strong, I thought I was going to pass out, and the two of the maids were still in there, and they wanted to come out and get fresh air. Mom wouldn't let them do it because that floor had to be disinfected. And so we had pretty healthy cars, I guess.
Would she beat them?
I saw two acts of violence while I was there. A lot of the accusations, I never was there to witness. But from what I've read and depositions from that case, I guess she was very, very violent with them.
Did you at any point think of this as, you know, my mother, my family is keeping slaves?
Involuntary servitude is a word that I should have known when I was a teenager, but I learned very, very well in the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
I put a couple of those maids on the plane in the middle of the night. They come up to me, hey, I got to get out of here. And the reason why I would help them leave wasn't so much that I think they were being beaten up, is because how hard they had to work and how unhappy they were and how they missed their family. I had empathy. I said, you know, if it was me, I'd want someone to help me get out of here. So I did.
Eventually, enough of them went to the police that your mother faced trial, federal charges. You don't see a lot of slavery trials.
There was two that I'm aware of after researching this that were even brought to trial. And I might be wrong. I think this is the only case that was actually won as far as a conviction for involuntary servitude.
And your mother served time in a federal penitentiary for that?
Yes. Yes. In fact, those 3 or 4 years is probably more responsible for what's become of Kenny and my mother today than any other time.
Why is that?
Well, my mom felt betrayed, number one. And whether she was or not, that's moot. It's just what she felt. That was a time frame where I believe Kenny's fate was pretty much sealed. And when she got out, she was just so angry, so much tension and anger built in there, that no one could contain that kind of rage. And that's when things, in my mind, went from grifters to the next level.
Did she change her behavior with the maids?
Well, after she got back from the jail, she did learn one lesson, that you can't do that with the illegal aliens. So her new maids were people from homeless shelters. They spoke English, and they were treated probably a little bit better than the maids were, but that was her new form of servitude.
I wonder, how much did alcohol play a part in all of this? At one point, you describe your stepfather and your mother knocking back, and this is hard to believe, was it 5 liters of alcohol a day?
The schedule's incredible. I look back at this now, and I can't believe that they're still alive. Wake up, have a screwdriver, and a screwdriver in the Kimes household was a screwdriver. It would screw you up because it was half alcohol, filled up with ice. The orange juice was pretty much for color. It wasn't for taste. And those big silo cups, those big plastic cups, would be always full. I don't remember seeing an empty glass. Then at noon, we had to switch to bourbon. And the bourbon, I mean, it looked like pure bourbon. And they put a splash of 7-Up in there just so they can say they had a light drink.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle of the night, they would get up and make another one. They'd have the glasses sitting outside there in the kitchen, so when they, and the ice in it, so when they'd wake up, then they could put, they drank bourbon and milk was at night, and it was intense. I didn't realize it at the time, but thinking about it now, it is just mind-blowing, the amount of alcohol that house went through. Expensive also.
And at the same time, your stepfather and your mother were both obsessed with physical beauty. I mean, if you're knocking back that much alcohol every day, it's not part of the spa treatment.
I don't know. I wouldn't want to go to that spa, but, you know, the plastic surgery, hair dye. In fact, it was kind of weird because I remember one time I saw Ken, and, you know, Ken was a very energetic man, a very driven man. I remember one time I saw him, he hadn't had a chance to color his mustache, and Mom hadn't colored his hair and stuff, and it frightened me how old he really did look. And for a man that you think is 20 years younger than he really is, and he looked 10 years older than what he really was.
What was your first rebellion against your mother? At what point did you start to distance yourself from her life?
The day my brother was born. Or not as... Well, let's talk about that. The day I found out about my brother. Kenny had been born a week before I even knew. I was pretty upset with that one.
I can imagine why.
That's one of my defining moments where I remembered, okay, something's not right here. And that's when I first had thoughts of Bolton, getting away from the situation. But, you know, I very quickly fell in love with my little brother. He was a great kid. And Ken and I had become attached. And, you know, it's pretty confusing for a teenager to have his, you know, 60-odd old stepfather begging not to go anyplace because he needed protection from my mother. And it worked. I actually felt kind of responsible for him in that respect and made me feel guilty for even thinking about leaving.
And the story after that, your story, is a constant series of attempts to get away and then being reeled back in.
The most relentless thing that my mother did to me is that she never would leave me alone. I fought it, but she got me one way or the other.
You didn't even know that she was pregnant.
My mother's always battled. The story is when I was born, I guess I was fighting to get out a little bit too much and it messed her up, her insides up. And she would constantly swell up. I mean, her stomach would swell up like a beach ball. And I'll be honest with you, I feel like a complete idiot now. Even at 12 years old, I should have known that she was pregnant because all the signs were there. But she wore the big clothes, and she always battled her weight, and she always had her stomach where it blow up like that. And so I didn't catch it. I come home one day after she'd been gone for a couple of weeks and said, "Hey, surprise, you have a little brother." And believe me, I was surprised. I was one big surprise guy.
And in retrospect, you conclude that she got pregnant in order to get a better hold on Ken Kimes and his millions of dollars.
Yeah, I don't think there's one thing that my mother ever did that was not calculated out to fit her plan. And the birth of my baby brother was definitely the purpose to snag and keep her millionaire.
Kent Walker's book is Son of a Grifter. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show and talk about the progression from con games to murder. I'm Neil Conan. This is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of Far Appalachia, Following the New River North by Noah Adams. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more about the woman the tabloids call the Dragon Lady. We'll continue our talk with Kent Walker, the other son of convicted killer Shante Kimes. Also, the music of improviser and saxophonist Anthony Braxton, modern jazz maverick.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan. My guest today is Kent Walker. His new book, Son of a Grifter, tells of life with his mother, Shantae Kimes, and his younger half-brother, Kenny Kimes. Shantae and Kenny are now serving life sentences for murder. Kent Walker is raising a family and selling vacuum cleaners in California. In his book, Walker describes his mother's many cons and crimes and how he was finally able to struggle free of her influence. Last year, Shantae and Kenny were convicted of the murder of 82-year-old Irene Silverman in New York City. They're suspects in at least three other murders. Earlier, Shantae served time for holding illegal aliens in involuntary servitude in her home. Kent Walker, you said after your mother got out of prison, she was so angry and became even more violent. What was the first sign of that that you saw?
Maybe I can illustrate it best this way. When you do something, it causes an effect, and that effect's going to have a cause on your life. Well, the things my mother was doing was causing some pretty negative effects in her life and the life of her families. What started out as shoplifting for lipstick then turned to cars. What turned into hiding stuff from stealing the cars had to manifest as hiding stuff from stealing houses. And when you steal houses, there's paper trails. And the only way to get the paper trails is by having someone help you forge documents. And pretty soon these people forging documents are your friends, but then they become enemies because they don't want to stand behind those documents. And you got to do something about those enemies. And then you do something about those enemies. It's how it just progresses. It's a very, very vicious circle.
How many people do you believe your mother and your brother killed?
I don't think we're ever going to know. I know the papers account for Irene Silverman.
Mm-hmm.
David Kazin was a friend. I have no doubt that they committed those crimes. I did not know the banker in the Caribbean. I have no doubt they did it, though.
This was a Bahraini who vanished after having a meal with your mother and your brother in the Bahamas.
Yep, pretty bad dinner. Last time he was seen alive was in the presence of Mom and Kenny, and in retrospect, it's impossible for me not to think they're guilty. I wish they weren't. I really do. But they are.
You suspect, you raise this in the book, you suspect that they may have killed your stepfather.
I'm still wrestling with that. You know, it's all retrospect and a lot of reflection. But little things come up in my mind that I remember now that should have been signs for me. And I think back about how the anger escalated. I think back how Kenny's anger escalated. I mistook it for a troubled young man in a situation that I was able I grew up in it. I understood what he was going through. I remember the angers that I had. And I was able to justify them. But looking back now, I can't say, yes, they had something to do with my stepfather's death. I pray not. I really do.
How did your stepfather die?
He had an aneurysm. Largest blood vessel in the chest cavity exploded. It took him about 30 seconds to die.
And he was an elderly man. Why were you suspicious at all?
My father visited me a week before that, and we had a very disturbing conversation. And at the time, I just chalked it up to life a la Kimes. Hindsight, reflection, I think I have reason to be concerned.
You think there was some drug or something that was used?
You know, I don't know if it's medically possible, but I know he had to have problems with blood pressure. But can you use stress as a tool for murder? I don't know. Can you create an environment where it's just so stressful enough to kill someone? I don't know.
It came completely unraveled for your mother and your brother when they went to New York City and tried to scam a woman named Irene Silverman and eventually ended up murdering her. And that's the crime that they were convicted of. When they were arrested and later went on trial, you didn't go to New York?
No.
Why not?
I didn't. I knew they were guilty, number one. When I found out about it, I read the paper. I knew they were guilty the minute I read the paper because I knew them so well. But I was also afraid that they're going to get away with it. Mom had gotten away with so much for so long. I just was afraid. And it wasn't my first rodeo. The Maids case had destroyed my life once before, and I thought I'd rebuilt it back up, but I didn't want to go through that again. And this one was different. The severity of the crime and the fact of where it happened, it just received so much press. And the only time I thought about coming to New York was at sentencing. I thought maybe I could show the court, you know, that Kenny, to a degree, is a victim. I'm not justifying what he did in any way, shape, or form. He needs to be held accountable for his actions. Mm. But I still believe that people need to understand that the kid never had a chance.
At this point, you were working as a vacuum cleaner salesman in Las Vegas, a job for which your mother had a great deal of contempt.
Oh, she hated it. She hated it. Shantae's boys are supposed to be stockbrokers, grifters. They're supposed to be developers. They're not supposed to be door-to-door salespeople. Not quite the glamour that she had in mind.
What was the?
I think that's why I did it, in fact. Half of it, I really enjoyed what I did, but part of it was a defiance to her. Every time she told me she didn't like it, made me want to do it more.
We talked about this yo-yo effect where you would go away and then come back in. What was the cause of the final break?
An argument. They told me they were broke. I don't know if they pulled one over me or not, but I think now, in hindsight, once again, that they were just taking one last shot to try to pull me into their stuff. But I let them stay in my house. They came over. They said they were broke. They needed some place to stay. And I said, well, I have a large home. I got a beautiful home. Worked hard for it. So come stay with me. And they started bringing the maids in again. They started fighting with my wife again. They moved into my house to destroy my life. And I finally realized that and looked at what was happening to my family. And I drew the line. I said, this is it. Goodbye. Never looked back.
Did you ever blow the whistle on your mother?
This is difficult, but I have more respect than most people do for law enforcement. I like them. I've been around them more than most people have also. I have empathy for them because I understand their job. But one of the biggest frustrations I have is that I tried to hand them Shantae on several occasions, but they wouldn't listen to me.
Tried to hand them Shantae? You went in and informed?
Yeah, I turned my mom in, and one time it cost me a lot, you know, and they just wouldn't listen.
Let me read something from your book. It's from about this period. I gave up. You've heard me say that before. This is where you gave up on me instead. By now, you probably don't like me too much, and you sure don't understand me. Let me guess what questions you'd like to ask. Couldn't I have tried a little harder to get the police to listen? Why didn't I grab Kenny and run? Why didn't I dump my mother for good after she tried to get me to hurt Jeff David, who was a family friend, after the nonsense with Roger the pimp? When I saw the picture of the maid's burned flesh when Shantae was in prison, after the second Portlock fire, this was an arson in your home in Hawaii, after I heard her confess to a murder? You posed the questions very well.
Yeah, those are probably toughest questions I have because those are the questions I ask myself continuously. Obviously, there's a lot of regrets in the life of Kent Walker, and those are the questions I'm looking for the answers for right now also. I did try. I'm a strong man. I inherited my mother's strength. It's like I tell people, I would have made a really good bad guy, but I didn't want to do the bad stuff. I want to do the good stuff. And I guess those questions are the questions I'll be asking myself for a long time.
Kent Walker. His book about his notorious mother is called Son of a Grifter. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Now we continue with my conversation with Kent Walker, who's written a family memoir called Son of a Grifter. What do you think is the difference between yourself and your brother? Why are you on a book tour now, and why is he in prison?
Well, you got the obvious. My brother killed people. I didn't. But then you have the issues that lead up to that. How come I turned out okay, or for the most part, not a murderer or a criminal of any way, shape, or form? I had, I was blessed because I had some real positive influence in my life as a kid. Fortunately, people who I love to this day, and who've been hurt by this also, one of my biggest regrets, who showed me what normal life could be like. And in a way, I can thank my mother, because I remember the tension of living that lifestyle. I didn't want to live that tension. And that was something that was taught to me at a young age. What was my tension turned out to be Kenny's excitement. That excitement, if you perceive it in that way, it is addicting, and it's insatiable. You cannot get enough of it, and this is the only way it's going to end up.
With the forced separation, Kenny, obviously in one prison, a dark fortress in upstate New York, in Dannemora, and your mother in another prison in Bedford Hills, rather a nicer prison. But with that separation, has Kenny broken the thrall?
No. I think that Kenny's starting to get it. Starting. I think he realizes that maybe he should have listened to me. I think he realizes why Big Brother fought so hard to pull him out of that situation. But he still remembers that excitement, that thrill of getting away with it, the desire for the big score. He wasn't immune to Mom's charisma. No one was. But he got addicted to it hard and fast. I think it'll be a long time before he realizes, if he ever does, the magnitude of the situation. He still loves his mother very much. And I think he still puts her well-being before his.
He could have copped a plea and gotten off with a much lighter sentence if he testified against your mother.
Yep. I wish he did it.
At the end of the book, you end with Kenny in prison and your mother also in New York State, both facing a very, very long sentences and fighting extradition to California, where they're wanted on additional murder charges. Where does it stand now?
Kenny was extradited to California. He's in Los Angeles now. Mom is using the system. She's fighting it, and I think it's going to be a very long time. I am told that that Los Angeles will most likely look for the death penalty. I have no idea what to expect on that.
Either way, if your mother and Kenny are convicted in California and executed, or if they go back and serve their sentence in the state of New York, probably they're both going to die in prison.
That's a given. That's a given. It's too late to do anything for Kenny. And, you know, Mom, she had a good run. I mean, it sounds crazy, his son saying this about his mother, but I wish she got arrested a long time ago. I wish, you know, this didn't happen. It's my prayer that they don't get executed, and it's a selfish prayer. I believe in justice, and the life terms that they've received is a just sentence. I believe that. With Kenny's situation especially, I don't think killing my brother is going to be justice. It'll be vindictive. And my kids didn't do nothing, and I don't want them to have to go through life knowing that their uncle was executed. I don't know how to explain that to them.
What do you tell them now about their grandmother, your daughter, your oldest daughter, was groomed to take your old role as the dodge, as the diversion?
I wouldn't say that she was groomed, but I would say that she was enticed. You know, my oldest has had a very hard time with this, and I want to pull her back out. I want to make her happy again. My two younger ones, I'm concerned about it. I'm not quite sure how to do it, and I'll find someone to help me. But my kids got a dad going to make them proud, and I'm going to make sure that they come through this as unharmed as possible. It's difficult.
Throughout this interview, we've been calling your mother Shantae. What's her real name?
Who knows? In fact, I saw her birth certificate, and I am convinced it's fake. It looks an awful lot like her writing, and it's an official document that you can call to Oklahoma and say, I need Shante or whatever the name was on it, birth certificate, and you'll get one, and it'll have the official seal. And I'm here to tell you, I'm not trying to hurt anyone's feelings, but she's that good. It's a fake.
What names did she go by in the times that you knew her?
I sat down and wrote down every alias I remembered, and I came up with over 100 different names that some she'd only use once, some she would use many times. But there's Walker, there's Kimes, there's Singrays, there's Chambers, there's Singers. there's so many, it's confusing to pull them out of the air.
And the first name, Sandy, Shante, Sante?
Yeah, first it was Sandy, then it was Santee, then Sante, then Shante, but there was also Nancy and Beth.
What's her background?
As far as?
Where's her family from? Yeah, where are people from?
Don't know. I've heard so many different stories that none will ever, I don't think I can ever believe one. I've heard the Oklahoma story that she came from Oklahoma. I've heard that she came from Pennsylvania. I've heard that she was on the streets with a prostitute mother, or that she came from a very affluent family who didn't know how to handle her. I kind of like it that way. That's makes me love everyone. I can't hate anybody for a color of their skin. That might be my brother. Well, they're all my brother, but you understand.
One of the odd things about this is that this woman celebrated in the tabloids as a consummate con artist. You point out that she really wasn't very good at it.
She was pretty good at the short term, but she screwed up long term every single time. She had nothing to show for her efforts.
The last time you saw your mother was in prison?
Yeah, last October.
And had any of this made an impact on her? Had she changed at all?
Yeah, she's changed. She's worse. I think she's lost her mind. Now, most people think she did that 50 years ago, but as far as the mother I knew, she's gone. She's created these lies and these situations and spun them and spun them and spun them to where I don't think she'll ever be capable to know what the real truth is. I don't think she'll ever be capable to feel guilty for what she's done. There'll never be any remorse. My mom's gone. The person who I grew up with isn't there anymore.
Even gone? Is your mother still conning people in prison?
I believe she is. I think she's the oldest woman in history to get arrested or put in solitary confinement for carrying a shank.
A shank is a prison knife manufactured.
Made of a pen, right. You know, and there was talk, I heard read reports that she was trying to get people to help her to escape also. She probably would have done if they didn't catch her. That's a scary thought.
Kent Walker, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Kent Walker's book is called Son of a Grifter. Coming up, the latest installment in our Avant-Garde Made Easy series. This is Fresh Air. Now part three of our series, Avant-Garde Made Easy. We invited jazz critic Kevin Whitehead to tell us about half a dozen modern jazz mavericks. Kevin says since 1970, no improviser has been attacked more fiercely or defended more passionately than saxophonist Anthony Braxton. Like Duke Ellington, Braxton doesn't call himself a jazz musician. He believes that some people use that word jazz as a label to try to limit what he can do. Braxton describes himself primarily as a composer. He's written operas and pieces for piano and for multiple orchestras, as well as for his own small groups. But Kevin says whatever else Braxton is, he's an original whose ideas enrich the jazz language.
When Anthony Braxton was a kid in Chicago, he played hooky from school one day to catch a parade and spied an adult he knew who'd skipped work to be there. Anthony rushed over to join him. It was his father. Braxton is fond of marches because parades bring a community together. He's fascinated by the social implications of music making and how music can be a force for positive change. As a diehard integrationist and a firm believer in American multiculturalism, Braxton won't restrict himself to any single style of music, even if some people want African Americans who improvise to just stick to jazz. His typically angular and asymmetrical music has been criticized for being too European. But you don't have to go to Europe to find precedents for that. The ending of Eric Dolphy's 1964 solo version of Love Me, made a few years before Braxton began recording, anticipates his leaps out of the alto sax's normal range, his extreme dynamic contrasts, and quirky timing. In 1968, Braxton made his first solo album, For Alto, which inspired many other horn players, including Steve Lacy and Evan Parker, to start playing solo concerts. Jazz saxophonists like Coleman Hawkins and Sonny Rollins had played occasional a cappella solos, but Braxton showed how to sustain an evening of them by building each one around a specific idea or two. One piece on For Alto uses trills of various speeds and intensity as cornerstones of an improvised line. In this case, that line also sounds informed by Asian solo flute musics. Later in that piece, Braxton uses a pet idea, alternating loud and soft phrases to create the illusion of two saxophonists, one near and one far. Here, one seems to interrupt the other, like the dummy heckling the ventriloquist. Alto was a conceptual breakthrough, but not everyone dug it, and Braxton quickly acquired a reputation as a boogeyman of the avant-garde. To show his love for the jazz tradition, he's made a few albums of standards, which haven't pacified his critics. In 1974, he played a nice version of Charlie Parker's Ornithology, but used one of the extreme horns he sometimes favors, a contrabass clarinet. Thank you. From 1985 to 94, Braxton's primary vehicle was his great quartet with pianist Marilyn Crispell, bassist Mark Dresser, and drummer Jerry Hemingway. Here he really went into conceptual overdrive, layering several pieces on top of one another. Like Charles Ives, another composer who was attentive to music's social role and loved marches, which he associated with his father. In the quartet, Braxton might improvise on one piece, while Crispell played a totally notated piano composition, and bass and drums played a complex pulse track. May strike you as chaotic, but most of us perform such complex maneuvers when, say, we surf the net, listen to the radio, and carry on a conversation at the same time, or talk on the phone while keeping tabs on two or three TV shows. For Braxton, playing or listening to multi-layered music can prepare us for a world where we're deluged with input. By his logic, contemporary improvising shouldn't sound like bebop, which evolved in an age of manual typewriters and prop airplanes. That makes sense. He's one visionary who's grounded in the everyday life of our time.
Kevin Whitehead is currently based in Chicago. Information about Anthony Braxton and his music can be found on the Fresh Air website, www.freshair.com. Next week, pianist Cecil Taylor. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharik directs the show. Research assistance from Brendan Noonan. For Terry Gross, I'm Neil Conan.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of Far Appalachia, Following the New River North by Noah Adams. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Paul Robeson Jr. discusses his new biography of his famous father, the undiscovered Paul Robeson. I'm Neil Conan. Join us for the next Fresh Air.